good morning, honourable members. Yes, we've got a document that has been circulated, and we've summarised all the issues that were raised at the public hearings the other day, and we've got our responses there. I'm just going to do a short introduction and ask Mrs. Lowe to take us through the document. And what I want to say in my introduction is really that our responses could be divided into three broad categories. The first table, or the first part of the responses, are in responses to issues that were raised in respect of the bill itself. And we indicate whether we support or whether we don't agree with those submissions and the reasons for that. So that's the first category of responses. The second category of responses is really about, there were quite a few representations proposing amendments that went beyond the scope of the bill. And maybe I should just pause there. Our instructions when we started developing the bill, when we received representations from the National Forum on the Legal Profession, our directions from our principals were was not to develop a bill that is really going to change the substance of the Legal Practice Act, because the council is not yet in operation, and we can accommodate and promote, where our instructions promote amendments that are going to facilitate the handing over from the old regulatory bodies to the new regulatory bodies. So that was our mandate, really, is to have a look at amendments that will streamline the handover, that will facilitate implementation, that will get the South African Legal Practice Council up and running. And we were aware of other proposed amendments to the Act itself, and our mandate from our minister, in any event, was we stick to what the bill is about and what's contained in the long title. And if you have a look at the long title, the focus, as we said before in the briefing on the bill, the focus is to facilitate implementation, to get the new regulatory bodies up and running. That's your South African Legal Practice Council, it's your board of the Fidelity Fund. And any amendments to the Act that don't deal with that should have the backing of the new regulatory body once it comes into operation. And we would like to see the new regulatory bodies up and running as soon as possible so that real transformation can really begin. So to get back to the second category of responses and the proposals to those amendments, while the department it might be sympathetic to some of the proposals where they were made, we would recommend that they don't be considered at this stage, but that is the prerogative of Parliament and this committee, of course. We will highlight what those proposals are during the course of our responses. We are also a bit concerned, and then the third category is proposals that were made that don't necessarily aren't exactly on the bill, but they fall within the scope of the bill itself and relate to the issues that this bill is intended to focus on, namely facilitation of handover, facilitation of implementation. So there might be a few other amendments, and that's the third category that the department would like to support, because they do not, because they fall within the scope of what the bill is about. And then we are concerned because the National Forum has a lifespan of 3 years, and that expires on the 1st of February 2018. And maybe one of the things that if we were to propose or support amendments that go beyond the scope of the bill, then it might be necessary in terms of the rules of the National Assembly to approach the National Assembly for approval to broaden the scope of the bill. So that I'd just like to do by way of background, Chair, honourable members, and if I could ask Mrs. Lowe to take us through the amendments itself, starting with.
Before that, I think we need the guidance of this honourable members, that the submissions have gone beyond the scope of the mandate, and now at the committee, I guess we also should agree whether we go beyond the mandate or not, because if we go beyond the mandate, that has also its implications. But it must be the decision of this committee to say there was a mandate, but of course there are other people who felt otherwise, but we cannot just act because somebody felt otherwise. We have to have guidance from this committee. Honorable Pumulani.
The mandate was the facilitation of the handover.
Which is not what is before Parliament.
There are three things. The first one is that the department saw it fit to go a certain direction, and therefore the mandate was based on that. And secondly, what did it mean if we only follow that and not consider the other, what the other people have proposed are problems within the act? It would mean to finish this bill and get another bill. This is what it would mean. Because if there are things that are being raised by other people, it means we make another bill and entertain, start from scratch, entertain all these submissions that they have made, which maybe the department or us feel they are proper. This is really something that would be an oversight. What do we do now? What I suggest, that it would save more time if, having had the submissions, you also find out that there are things in the submissions, though there may not be according to the original mandate, but they make sense, and that we probably would save time and actually money by expanding the that mandate, and then I need to be informed as to, is it really a big deal, you know, if what can't we manage that? Because then the alternative would be that maybe a new bill will be brought. I just want to be directed on that, because personally I feel that those things that were raised that are beyond the scope of the bill need to be entertained by this committee and see, because one, it will assist in terms of it will save in terms of time. It will also assist, because if they are really crucial things, if for example people go to court and say, come on, your act is against the constitution for A, B, C, and D, and parliament, it is a long way. If we ourselves see that there is a need for that, I think personally, let's hear their comments, and then perhaps we can sit down and look into the matter. But I want to know whether it will be a big deal to combine the two. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable. I think when we deal with this matter, we must also be mindful of the fact that we have a deadline. whether that approach will not affect the deadline. But let me keep that question also open to contributions. Honorable Madam.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I concur with the idea that we should actually be mindful of the fact that there are deadlines, especially in terms of the transition period and the transition strategy that we need to actually approve. And also to take into consideration the fact that the term of office of the forum is actually ending and how to begin and deal with it. What Honorable Pumlan is actually also saying, he's saying we shouldn't actually then do away with all that are actually, which is actually important in terms of implementation of the Civil Practice Act. And I think also to note the concern that was raised about the forum itself. When you actually see the process. Subsequently, the report has been submitted. We haven't engaged on that report, which was the process that was supposed to have happened before the bill was actually presented before us. So I would actually concur with the check to say maybe because of the deadlines, let's proceed with the bill and then develop a way of dealing with all that has been raised. And we can actually begin with presentation before us of that report of the forum. Because we need to know what it is that they're doing. Is what they are doing actually managing to help implement the Legal Practice Act? Is it actually managing to drive transformation of the legal fraternity in South Africa? And it's something that is actually important for us to know. And we don't want to do it unilaterally. Maybe we need to do it with the profession itself. So what would be important would be probably maybe also to have some form of a public hearing process. So that the lawyers can come and tell us what it is that they're bickering about. Because there's bickering, especially black lawyers. And then we should look at what is it that is actually being done by the forum and whether whatever was developed in the form of a Legal Practice Act is actually assisting the process.
We seem to be speaking in the dark. Is it possible that we can hear the presentation so that we know which thing he's talking about? You know, and he just says they are those. I think let's hear which ones before we can comment, because we don't know. Maybe there are things that would agree with you.
With respect, I put a prior question. The prior question is, let's first settle the question whether we also as the committee go beyond the mandate, and then if the answer is yes, then we hear those matters, and if the answer is no, we do what you do, we hear what is being said, but not for the purpose of a decision. Before we I rule on the matter, Let's allow other members to speak.
Are you saying that we must decide on the things we don't know? Because you can say these are the things. I just want to find out. These are the issues that are beyond the mandate. These are the issues that are within the mandate. He is the only one who has you know which ones. I just want that clarification.
No, I agree with you. All I'm saying is that I put a question. Let's first hear other members put their hands that were raised. Honorable Mukwale.
Thank you, Chair. Greetings to the members and the departments and other guests. Chair, I do not think we differ in this matter. What Honorable Majale proposed and what Honorable Mpumlan is saying as well can somehow be trying to be synergized. I support the view that let's stick on the mandate because compliance is important. Let's stick on the mandate, but immediately when we are done with those issues, we also listened to what has been regarded as exceeding the mandate. which might, in the other case, lead us on what Honorable Majali is saying, public hearings, because they are very important as well, because these practitioners must speak to us. I think we can do both of those things. Let's continue with those issues that are within our mandate. We listen and we engage on them. But however, we do not close the session without also hearing what has been regarded as exceeding. Because I'm of the view that even though there can be things that exceed the mandate, it was because of a reason. There was a reason behind. There was some concerns behind. So we can do both of those things. But obviously, we prioritize what is within the mandate as stipulated by Parliament.
So thank you, Honourable Mugabe. Any other Honourable
Thanks, Chairperson. I feel persuaded by what Honourable Mugabe is saying, that we focus first on what we mandated the department to do, and later on then we hear these other issues which apparently they had to be captured because they felt that they were important. Thank you very much.
Any other contribution? I think as the chair,
I'm persuaded by Honorable Mwabe, Honorable Maila, and Mema Jake, that for now, we deal with what was mandated, but again, in agreement with Honorable Mpumulwana, we hear things that were outside the mandate, because that may also enable us to say to the department, having received these other recommendations, maybe you need to go back and come up with a bill and come back to us because we can't make the bill. So can we agree that the two are not mutually exclusive, but for the purpose of our proceedings, we want to deal with the mandate and listen to the other things, take note of that without discussion. So I think Honorable Mwale, Honorable Maida, Honorable Majaki are saying that the Honorable Mwale, what you are saying is not out of order. We will listen to those submissions that went before without making a decision on that. Would you be happy with that?
As long as there's no decision taken until we hear what those things are.
No, we are competent to take a decision on the mandate, but not on the other extra issues. Can we operate on that basis?
Honorable, the committee seems to be...
Thank you very much, Chair. Can I hand over to Mrs. Lowe? I'm sure that there are going to be even more proposals for amendments when the new structure is coming to place. And I think that the decision of this committee is a wise decision, if I may say so, because then we are doing a bill with the backing of the new regulatory structures, the new transformed structures. And I think that is what...
And actually, in support of what Honorable Majaki said, the forum itself has requested that on the 1st they give us a report. And their report will also help us to see, identify the need for how we move forward. So I think we are all moving in the same direction. So proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to ask Mrs. Lowe to take us through the document.
Thank you. Chair, honourable members. Chair, could I just have guidance? Do you want me to go clause by clause and every clause discuss the comments received? Shall I proceed like that?
If we were able to isolate the clauses that deal with the mandate, it would be less confusing to us. And when we have dealt with that, then the second stage would be to deal with the other additional things which were not within the mandate.
Clause 1 of the bill is just a small insertion that brings the Act on par with the current Attorneys Act to provide that the new council can also help with the establishment, etc., of insurance schemes, etc., for its members. There were some comments in this respect from one person, but she didn't really motivate her representations, and the department does not agree that this could be in any manner a problem. So it is suggested that Clause 1 does not have to be amended in this respect. Then Clause 2 provides for a matter relating to the areas of the jurisdiction of the Provincial Council. This is basically a technical amendment. There is a provision in the Act that could be construed as a contradiction. It must be in the regulations. The Minister must provide for this in the regulations. And so we just insert this may from time to time to make sure that there is no contradiction in this respect. It's very technical, and it will ensure that there is a smooth transition towards the establishment of the provincial councils. There were some comments on this clause. Chair, I don't know if you want to go through every single comment. Shall I do that? All right. The Commission for Gender Equality proposed that the minister, that the insertion must be done, namely that the minister must review the areas of jurisdiction every 5 years. Now, the response to this could be that Section 97.1 of the Act already provides that the forum must make recommendations regarding several things, including the areas of jurisdiction. And Section 23.2b provides that the minister must prescribe these areas, and that is in regulation then. And then Section 97.1a is in the Act for purposes of establishing the first provincial councils and their areas. Section 23.2b allows the minister to prescribe the jurisdiction, so it's this kind of duplication. And then Clause 2 only suggests that Section 23.2b be amended in order to clarify the difference between 23 and 97.
Chair, it's really 97.1 is where the National Forum is, it's intended to establish the first councils, the first provincial councils. And then those boundaries might be changed in time to come, and that's why it says may from, Section 23 says may from time to time determine the boundaries of the provincial council. So there might be a need sometime in the future to change those boundaries. And the Gender Commission is saying that the Minister must review the jurisdiction of the provincial councils every 5 years. And we're saying it's not necessary to have the boundaries reviewed every 5 years. It's a big issue. And, you know, once that is settled, the need for changing provincial council areas of jurisdiction should only be done as and when it is deemed absolutely necessary. So we don't want to have that reviewed every 5 years.
Maybe we should deal with that. Honourable Madam Chair.
On the, I think it's just about the issue of official boundaries not mentioned in this document.
Sorry, I might have used the wrong terminology. That's the areas of jurisdiction. Areas of jurisdiction of the provincial councils.
Areas of jurisdiction of the provincial councils shouldn't be following the official boundaries of the provinces. So that it shouldn't become the responsibility of the minister to, from time to time, review. What should the review be based on?
Well, I think there was a long debate about this when the Act was being deliberated, And there was talk about, shouldn't there be a provincial council for every nine province, of the nine provinces? And it was felt at the end of the day, and Mrs. Lowe must help me with my memory, was felt at the end of the day, there might, the legal profession must fund itself. It's not going to get any funding from government. And it shouldn't get any funding from government because of the independence of the legal profession. And it might be a question of finances. It might not be viable to have a provincial council in all nine provinces. And that's why it was left open, so that the profession itself can decide what it can afford and what is practical and what the needs of the profession are to do justice for the clients of lawyers. And that's why it was left open like that. It was deliberately left open, and one of the main reasons, this is a thing that the legal profession must decide, that the minister must implement that decision of the legal profession. And it is based to a large extent, I think, on practicalities and budgetary constraints.
Thank you, Honourable Chief, for this and Mr. Bassett for the action. Through you, Chairperson, Mr. Bassett, don't you think that if we leave that to legal practitioners to decide, don't you think are we related back to the former four colonies to have Law Society of Northern Provinces taking Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Northwest and Gauteng and so forth? That's why I would like to align myself with what Honorable Majake has said, that why not align this with the official constitutional recognized boundary? Thank you, Chair.
I just want to find out the legal profession bodies presently not commented on this. Haven't they made any suggestions so far? If we're going to say it's going to be left with them, haven't they talked? I thought the Law Society was here, there was another bar that was here, and so on. Didn't they comment about it? I thought they did. So. And if so, aren't we? What are you saying about that if they did?
Can we also bear in mind the fact that the Gender Commission, we're dealing with the proposal of the Gender Commission of a 5-year review. But you review when there's a need arises. Now the proposal says from time to time, which means when there's no need, you don't review, especially because the review must be affordable by those who have the review. Can we first settle that question? Then the second question would be the alignment question. Why don't we deal with align this boundaries with the provincial boundaries? Can we hear you on the Honorable Majority?
First, on the proposal of the Gender Commission, shouldn't we?
Thank you, Chair President. The Gender Commission didn't even have any time to talk to the proposal. When we listen to the Commission, we eventually managed to get an opportunity to engage them on it. And then I still go back to looking at just leaving it according to the constitutionally recognized boundaries of the country. And re-emphasizing the point that was actually made by Nemo Tab. See, our fear is to still come up with own structures that may hinder transformation. But if we are serious about transformation, we need to actually also allow ourselves to come up with structures that will have ability to talk to transformation issues.
Honorable Majaki, you are right. The Gender Commission did not appear before us. but they have made a submission. They want us to review every 5 years, and we have to we have to settle that question ourselves, whether we agree with the committee or not. Then if we don't agree, then we say so and move on to the question that you have correctly raised.
Can I ask a question? I thought you were putting the box before the cut. Or the cut. If we don't know what is to be reviewed, can we now decide on whether review should be 5 years or not? Can we start with what is in front of us? In other words, this is why I asked, was there any comment on that? So that we know this is what is in front of us. And they are saying, therefore, the commission says that this, what is in front of us, should be reviewed after 5 years. I think what my manager again, and I'm trying to say that, what's there?
No, I think what they are saying is that, you see, there's a proposal which may mean that we don't use the 9 provinces. We leave it to the legal profession. And then they are suggesting that why don't we align with the 9 provinces? That's what they are saying, so we know what is before us. Mr. Bassett, can you address?
Thank you, Chair. I'll be just checking. I can't recall that I'm asking
this. Address both questions raised by Honourable Ndunga and the four-year member from Mutapo and the member.
As far as we can see, and I can recall, the legal profession hasn't made any comments on this proposal, because I think it was sort of a settled question. It was a settled question at the time that the Legal Practice Act was debated, that this is what it would be, that the National Forum would make recommendations for the Minister to implement if he agrees with that. I think it's in consultation. Is it after consultation? In consultation, so there's got to be agreement by the minister. So from the political level, there must be agreement from the minister's side, from the executive side. The recommendation comes from the National Forum. They make the recommendation on the first provincial councils and their areas of jurisdiction. And as I said, it is largely related to financial considerations. So we haven't had any comments from the legal profession to answer the Honourable Mbuwana, because I think as far as the legal profession is concerned, that is something that's settled, and that's why there were no comments on it. As I've indicated, the National Forum, and this is one of the things that I'm sure the National Forum will come and address this committee on, is the first provincial councils and their areas of jurisdiction. And my understanding, and I don't want to preempt, and that's just what I've heard, that the provincial, that the national forum is recommending indeed 9 provincial councils. So to try and allay your fears, the recommendation that's going to be made by the forum to the minister to implement is 9 provincial councils. And then to get back to the Commission on Gender Equality's proposal that these must be reviewed every 5 years, the department's response is that, you know, the areas of jurisdiction can be amended from time to time, but if there's no need for a review, why do it every 5 years? Because what does a review entail? It entails an investigation and time and money, and the departments of the view that something like this should only be revisited when there's a need that's identified and that need is very clear. And to have to review it every 5 years, going through the motions and make this rubber stamp thing, the department feels it's unnecessary to do.
But we also bear in mind that we are not legislating for the lawyers and for the ministry. We are legislating for South Africans. And one of the hallmarks of law is certainty. Now, if we are going to make laws which keep people saying every 5 years we must go and review the boundaries, it's now about ourselves, not about the people. Now, that takes me back to the proposals by Honorable Majak and Honorable Mutapa, that why not align? Because we'll be creating certainty, and South Africans will know where we're going, and that the law should not depend on what the lawyers want and what the ministry wants. And you say the legal profession is not opposed to the alignment. Now, if they are not opposed, the question is, as the committee, what are we saying? Do we support this review every 5 years or from time to time, or do we support the alignment as proposed by the two honourable members? Honourable Maile.
Thank you, Chair. This thing of review every 5 years is quite a problem. You see, you can see what happens with the Municipal Demarcation Board. Every 5 years, we have boundaries being changed, people being confused. I think we need consistency, Chairperson. And I would support the proposal that the boundaries should be aligned to the existing provincial boundaries. Thank you very much.
Any other honourable member?
Thank you, Chair. No, I also support the alignment, because this review, to me, it brings uncertainty in the law. If you are at every 5 years, you must go back and review this. I think alignment will make it much better and professional. Thank you.
You see, if the question of affordability of otherwise, you can say we'll do this progressively because of financial constraints, but it gives more certainty to the people to say these structures must be aligned to the provincial boundaries which are set by the Constitution. So we give certainty, and the people of this country understand where we are going, but we can make laws which are hanging somewhere. But Christine, you want to add something?
I just wanted to add that the Act in Section 23 actually provides progressive establishment of provincial councils in every province of the country. So already within the Act, we're saying that there needs to be provincial councils in every province.
So there's also the law supports us that alignment is provided for
and the implementation may be progressive. So can we accept the position of the majority, Mr. Nwabe, Mr. Maina, Honorable Nwabe, Honorable Maile, Honorable Mutapo, Honorable Majake, that there must be alignment with the nine provinces?
Chair, the department won't, the legislature and parliament has spoken. The amendment that we've got here in clause 2, and I think is a technical amendment, and I'm just again raising this, we, by all means the department will prepare the amendments to give effect to what has been decided here. I am just raising it, and I don't have the exact answer. I don't know whether my colleague from parliamentary researchers...
Yes, hold on. I think the honourable members are consulting. No, you have the right to consult because we are taking national decisions. Finish what you say.
What I was going to suggest, the honourable chair, is that it should be better if we just listen to the presentation by Mr. Burton, the department, and then we meet as a committee and decide on issues. This is what I'm saying, before Mr. Burton does that decision by the committee, before Mr. Burton does that decision by the committee. I think it's new to me, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but I would think that normally when they present, we note, and then together we sit, consider that. Oh, no. Because in that manner, as you know, comrade, honorable chairman, that perhaps we could, you know, we could also meet together and other people meet, and then they say, in this way, they see it that way. Rather than now before the press and before the other presentations that are made, we don't make decisions, let them do it. And then we know, and then we
come back. Unfortunately, you were outside. We took a decision that we are going to deal with this matter clause by clause. And now the clause that we are dealing with points to, we agreed that we're dealing with the matters clause by clause. Now we were considering the matter of whether or not boundaries should be reviewed after every 5 years or from time to time. We say that such an approach will introduce uncertainty, and we don't want uncertainty because we are not legislating for the ministry and the lawyers. We are legislating for South Africans. And therefore, the second question was whether these boundaries should not be aligned with the nine provinces, which is a constitutional matter, and the committee agreed that they need alignment with the nine provinces. So that matter is settled. So it would be a question of moving to the next clause as per the agreement of the committee. Thank you for your understanding. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Just, if I may, alert the committee, and I'm not too sure whether I'm correct, but and we will go and do those amendments, because there are a few amendments that we'll have to effect to Section 97 and Section 23 of the Act to give effect to the decision that's taken here. The amendment that we've got in Clause 2...
No problem with the members of consulting, but I have a problem with the hearing an explanation, the consultation, then it will talk of cross purposes.
If you still want to consult, you are free to do so, but let's allow Mr. Bassett to be heard. Can he proceed?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. as I was saying, I just want to raise the alert or maybe a concern, and I hope it's not going to be a concern, but I think committee members should know about it. This might just give rise to the question, isn't ARNB extending the scope of the bill? And we would need to get approval from the National Assembly. So that brings us back to, I'm just asking the question because, if the Honourable Chair would maybe like to hear from Ms. Silkstone, because this is more a parliamentary issue than it is a departmental issue.
give us some 5 minutes. Just gather your thoughts. Members are gathering their thoughts. We must apologize.
Honourable members who are outside, please come in.
That's the way I understand it. But I just want to point out to the committee, if you read clause section 23 of the Act, that deals with establishing provincial councils, and it says the council must, subject to subsection 2 and progressively, establish a provincial council in every province. So it must establish in every province of the Republic a provincial council. So that is already there. But subsection 2 of section 23 says the council must, at the commencement of chapter 2, that's also when the council comes into operation, establish at least 4. So as a starting point, there must be at least 4. But the ending point, there've got to be 9. And section 23.2a says the council must, at the commencement of chapter 2, establish at least 4 provincial councils, and the following factors must be taken into account. There may not be more than one provincial council per province. The location of the seats of the divisions of the High Court must also be taken into account. The efficient attainment of the council's objects, availability of resources, cost effectiveness and feasibility, interests of legal practitioners and candidate legal practitioners, provincial needs, interests and sensitivities, and last but not least, the interests of the public. So the Act already envisages 9, but at the beginning there must be at least 4. And as I say, all these factors must be taken into account. But they're working towards 9. But my understanding is, I repeat, is that the National Forum is going to recommend right from the outset that there be 9 provincial councils.
Honourable members, I think maybe this is where we must also talk about overreach of law. The position of the committee is that we align with the provinces
But this act, which appears to have been some kind of compromise, says that the interests of the legal profession, responsibility, last but not least, I'm wondering whether there's no overreach of some kind. But let me, Christine, you want to throw some light before we take the matter forward? Because as the members were saying, we may even be retaining the Bantustan arrangements through the BEPO.
Confusing things further, but from my recollection was that the reason for the progressivist, for providing for a progressive establishment, was that the committee at the time was concerned that because the legal state, the provincial councils would need to be funded by the actual profession itself, it might actually be forced advocates and attorneys in areas where there wasn't a very big presence. You know, it would make them, their operations prohibitive in terms of costs and so on. So the idea was to allow them to establish themselves facilities. But I also wanted to confirm, well, Jill told me that the national forum has reported to us, I think in their last, what Jill was in the last report.
I think so, yeah.
That the decision is that there will be 9 provincial councils.
So couldn't it be that we are moving ahead without
even receiving that report of the forum, which should throw more light on this, because I think we may be fishing in troubled waters. Honorable Mugen.
I don't think it's our fault to find ourselves in the space in which we are now. The forum has not been engaging. But now, what we are pronouncing today is that we follow the officially recognized boundaries in terms of the Constitution, which is in a way, in terms of what you're actually saying, what the forum is actually busy with, but has not been brought before us. What is good is that it doesn't actually contradict what they are thinking. When it does, what it means is that we continue with our decision, which is almost in office, but it's coming to us, but still on its way to us. What we need to actually avoid, we're talking about overreach, I don't know if we manage to understand properly. You still say the forum must recommend to the minister. So we are saying what we are actually deciding on, we must leave to the forum to go and recommend to the minister. In other words, it actually neutralizes what we are actually talking about now. We want it to be final so that we know that we are going to follow constitutionally recognized boundaries. In terms of the decision that is actually being made by the government today.
Maybe to come in a little bit there, if you read the subsection, it talks about interests of the legal profession, affordability, and so on. Those qualifications, are those qualifications not neutralizing what we're trying to do? Can you address us first on that?
Before that,
yeah.
I just want to find out, didn't I read somewhere in the act that the boundaries are according to the Constitution?
Yeah, you're right.
That thing, and that if there are 2 or 3, I'll call
4
Yes, then there will be advocate or something like that, representing that. Don't we have that? Now, what are we talking about? Are we saying that needs to be taken? Exactly that. What exactly? I'm trying to be only saying.
What the committee has said is that they need alignment with the provinces.
Which is
already there.
In the act, yeah.
Yes, and I think we are confirming that. But there is this question that the implementation has got to be progressive, but subject to this consideration of affordability,
the interest of the legal practitioner and the asset in life and so on. Can you just restate that, sir?
Thank you, Chair. Yes. Clause section 23.2 says, let me repeat section 23.1, which says the council must, subject to subsection 2 and progressively, establish a provincial council in every province of the Republic. Section 23.2a says the council must, at the commencement of chapter 2, that's when this council comes into operation, establish at least 4 provincial councils, that's to start off with, and the following factors must be taken into account. Firstly, there may not be more than one provincial council per province. The location of the seats of the divisions of the High Court must be taken into account. The efficient attainment of the council's objects must be taken into account. The availability of resources, cost effectiveness and feasibility. The interests of legal practitioners and candidate legal practitioners. Provincial needs, interests and sensitivities, and the interests of the public. And then section 23.2b says the minister must prescribe the areas of the provincial councils in consultation with the council.
And what are we saying about it? You see, the other thing is we must be informed by what is on the ground. When these matters were dealt with, we still had the Botswana situation, the Bishaw and the Transkei things, the Toyando things, and the honorable members, as I understand it, they want certainty in the law, they want a transformative piece of legislation. I'm not sure that we are not actually sourcing out our right to make a law that is certain, sourcing it out to the legal profession, and the interest of the legal profession does not necessarily coincide with the interest of the people of South Africa.
Sorry, it's a decision that this committee must. I just want clarity on what we as a department must do. As I say, there must be nine provincial councils in every province. But the message, the sense that I'm getting is that we must delete subsection 2.
Delete subsection 2.
Yeah. Is that what I'm
getting? Yes.
I would think that the word progressive in subsection 1 should also be deleted. You see, you have it says it must be progressive, and then at least 4, and then gradually, and that graduality will. The problem is it may never have happened. If you are very decisive and say 9, full stop. And then when they establish, if they don't have enough money, they want to establish 9 until they got enough money to establish 9. But then you can't say start with 4. And, this is what we're saying. And the progressive must be removed. That's what I would suggest.
Honorable Majority.
No, as a president, in fact, what I was actually saying is, in terms of establishment of provincial councils, let them be established without any form of rationalization, because this is what will actually create a problem in the future. We say, in accordance with the issue of resources and monies, and in future you're going to find that we have a system that we don't agree to, with the reason being there isn't enough money. I don't know at what point does money become enough. Because what it means is that within the available resources, this structure that we are actually recommending should actually be established. instead of buying bigger offices, you buy smaller offices to actually make it a point that it manages to exist.
I have said that the legal forum requested that they come and make a presentation on the first. So maybe we will give them a hearing then, and then we can take forward the debate. But for now, the position of the honourable members is clear, that they don't want all these conditionalities and things like that.
I just had uncertainty in my mind what we were requesting, what you were requesting. Now I understand exactly what you
said. Thank you very much. And honourable members, thank you for your guidance. Let's proceed.
Thank you, Chair. There was another comment on clause 2. The person said that the amendment must be consulted with the NCRP, and it will in the normal course of events in any way happen, so that can be ignored. Then there was a comment on clause 2 that the minister must within 12 months define the jurisdiction of the provincial council, but after our discussion just now, I suppose we can just ignore that comment also, because events have now taken over this comment. And then there's support for this clause, and then the next clause is clause 3. There was a comment on clause 3. Clause 3 inserts the word practicing before legal practitioner into section 33 of the Act. This was at the request of the Law Societies and the National Forum. The Commission for Gender Equality has a comment. They propose a penalty clause to make it an offence, but our response is that there is already a penalty clause in section 33, so that is unnecessary. Then the National Council of the National Bar Council of South Africa has a comment on this, and their problem is that there's no definition for the term practicing legal practitioner, and they raise the the issue that will it only apply to people who attend court, etc. They have a lot of problems with this. We have a long response to their comment. In the department's view, Section 3 of the Act that deals with the purpose of the Act provides that the purpose is inter alia to create a single unified statutory body to regulate the affairs of all legal practitioners. Then, Section 5 of the Act, that deals with the objects of the Council, it provides that the objects of the Council are inter alia to regulate all legal practitioners and candidate legal practitioners. And then the question is, what is a legal practitioner? Section 1 of the Act defines it as an advocate or attorney who is admitted and enrolled in terms of Sections 23 and 20 and 30. A legal practitioner is admitted in terms of Section 23 by the High Court, and then that legal practitioner becomes an officer of the court. After admission, that person must enroll in terms of Section 30. And this is an application to the Council for enrollment. And that application for enrollment must indicate whether the legal practitioner intends to practice as attorney or advocate. That person can elect to be on the non-practicing role. In other words, there's two roles, one for practicing and one for non-practicing. This is similar to the current position in terms of the Attorneys Act, where there's a separate role for practicing attorneys who actively practice and they have fidelity fund certificates. And then there's a role for non-practicing attorneys. They are admitted, but their names are enrolled as non-practicing and then they don't have to have fidelity fund certificates. Many legal advisors fall in this category. But they remain officers of the court and members of the legal profession, and the court can then strike their name if they do serious misconduct, etc., and that they become unbecoming to be an officer of the court and a member of the legal profession. So the term practicing legal practitioner is used in numerous places in the Act where it's necessary to distinguish between practicing and non-practicing. And it has the ordinary meaning, namely if you are practicing, you pursue a profession actively. And the Attorneys Act currently also distinguish and have numerous references to practicing attorneys. The National Bar Council has further comments regarding the position of consultants, and the Banking Association refers to corporate counsel. It is important at the outset to state that the Act is intended to regulate the affairs of legal practitioners with a focus on practicing legal practitioners. The Act does not focus on consultants or corporate counsel, law advisors in the private sector. But there are limited instances in which the Act may have a bearing on corporate counsel. For instance, legal advisors who are admitted and enrolled as legal practitioners on the role of non-practicing practitioners, and if they are found to be guilty of serious misconduct and becoming of an officer of the court. If a non-practicing legal practitioner in the private sector do not wish to fall under the jurisdiction of the Act, they will have to remove their names from the non-practicing role. There are also private sector legal advisors who have legal qualifications but who have never been admitted and enrolled as legal practitioners, and they do not fall under the Act at all. Their position is regulated by normal employer-employee relationship. So the department is of the view that it's unnecessary to define the term practicing legal practitioner. Section 33 deals with the authority to render legal services, and it sets out a small list of work that specifically reserves for practicing legal practitioners, and those work all relate to court. And non-practicing legal practitioners are not allowed to carry out these functions because they do not have fidelity fund certificates, and that is to the protection of the public. The proposed amendment will not preclude corporate counsel from continuing to offer legal services for remuneration so long as those services do not amount to the reserved work. So the insertion of the word practicing is for the public good, in that legal practitioners who carry out reserved work will do so with the backing that comes with the Fidelity Fund certificate.
Honorable members, I think we have a difficulty of making laws for South Africans where you have the dominant interests are the ones that seem to dictate the direction, not the interests of the people. There are people that are academics. Academics, where do they fall? Do they have to have a fidelity certificate? The people in the corporate, do they have to have a fidelity? Why all these restrictions and things like that? It becomes just too complicated. Can you maybe
restate, honorable members, let's just listen, because we cannot make a law which has challenges, and then we amend and have an amendment of the challenges, and we then have to address one law three times. Can you just go slow and explain what is in that?
Thank you, Chair. Basically, the situation is that the Legal Practice Act only pertains to practitioners. Currently, the people who fall under the Attorneys Act and the Admission of Advocates Act. Those two groups are now put together under the Legal Practice Act. Just as at this moment, the Admission of Advocates Act and the Attorneys Act are not applicable to state law advisors such as myself or people that work at the banks or private companies. They do not fall under those two acts currently, and they do not fall under the Legal Practice Act. They are in a normal situation. You work for Standard Bank, you have a normal employer-employee relationship. Even though you might be an admitted attorney or you might be an admitted advocate, you are in employment. And so, personally, I think that the deletion of the word practicing in the Legal Practice Act was an oversight when we did the Act, because it's a very, very risky situation for the public if a person who's a non-practicing law advisor, legal practitioner, can do the reserved work. In other words, you could get a person who's a law advisor at the bank, and now he appears in court, but he doesn't have a Fidelity Fund certificate, so that client is not protected. So this is basically, it sounds very long-winded, the thing that I just told, but it's actually a very technical amendment. It's just for the protection of the public, that a person who does those work must be on the practicing role. In other words, he or she must have a Fidelity Fund certificate.
Okay, do you subject those non-practicing people to the authority of the new council?
Chair, in a very, very limited sense. For example, say a person is on the non-practicing role and now he's a law advisor in a private company and he does something very bad. Then in theory, someone could bring an application to the council and say, listen, that guy is on the non-practicing role, but he brought the profession in such disrepute that we think he should be taken off the non-practicing role. But that is only in theory. But the basic thing is, when you decide on a career path, you must decide, I want to be a practicing attorney or advocate, just as it is at the moment. Or even though I am admitted, for example, as an advocate or an attorney, I want to go on the non-practicing role and want to go corporate or work for the state or for a municipality, and then you go on the non-practicing role. So you can't do the reserved work, then we appear in court. But you can do everything else.
That if is you are not a member of this club, because apparently we are establishing a club, why should the club have authority over the non-members of the club?
Chair, as I say, it's in a very limited sense. But if you don't want to belong to that club, you can take your name off the role of non-practicing.
Why should you? Because if you are employed by the bank wants your services, but you are not part of the club. Why should you be subject to the rules of that club, which are made in your absence? No taxation without representation.
Chair, are they coming there? It's really because it's important to know that when you get admitted as an attorney and you get enrolled as an attorney, you become an officer of the court. And you, when you go and apply for a job at the bank, say, I'm an admitted attorney, but I'm not practicing. So you get the work, you get the job, you get the post, because you're using the name of the attorney's profession. So if you are an officer of the court, you are going to fall under the jurisdiction of the council, as Mrs. Lowe said, very good. If you bring the attorney's profession into such disrepute, there'll be limited circumstances, but you might, for instance,
I think honourable member, can you respond to honourable member?
Thank you, Secretary. What is actually being presented here is actually one. Because it actually means that the public is exposed. In the sense that the incident, what it is actually saying is saving, protection, anything. To ensure that anybody that works for us is actually offering in the legal facility. It's about accountability in terms of the legal practices and activities within the legal system. So if you're talking about non-practicing and practicing, attending, and if you look at it, in between what's going to be discussed would be monitoring all of this within the country. Because earlier about this, you got a member of the But then we only get to know when somebody is actually in that situation that the person is opposed. Why do we allow a situation to be South African in situation particularly? Because in an MMA which we have laws, should be in such a way that the way that the law is implemented automatically protects South African. Why would people want to actually practice law when they do not want to actually be accountable to the authority of the legal fraternity? Because what the non-practicing attorneys are actually saying, we have studied law, we know the law, but we want to work outside the system that has been created to actually sanction anything that has something that is wrong between the legal fraternity. What I'm saying is that you need to actually have this law in such a way that as long as you want to do any form of law in front of you, it's like when people want to become doctors, I'm not a practicing doctor and therefore I'm not going to be registering whatever bodies. Because those bodies are actually meant to be sure that you are compelled to have ethical conduct. And if there's no ethical conduct, you will then therefore be sanctioned. It's something that has actually been put in place as a deterrent. So here there's no deterrent. People can come in and the conduct, they go into banks and they do all sorts of things that may be unethical using the law of South Africa, and then have themselves manage to operate unhindered. We need to have in place a mechanism that is actually not allow that to actually happen.
What are the submissions of the corporate lawyers themselves on this list?
Sorry, Chair, the Banking Association made submissions. They were unsure whether the Act applies to them or not. And we, as I just explained, the Act does not pertain to corporate lawyers. One has to make a career choice in South Africa. If you want to become a practicing attorney or advocate, you fall under, at the moment, the Attorneys and Advocates Act, and you will fall under the Legal Practice Act. If you want to become, for example, I'm an admitted attorney, as I sit here. I'm on the Law Society's non-practicing role. So, but I am governed by the laws of my employer, the state. So it's not that if I just want to practice law and do what I want, I am still subject to the laws and to my employer-employee relationship that I have. But it's a career choice I make. I do not want to practice, so I don't want to have a fidelity fund certificate, etc. But it doesn't, it's a career choice. And so the banking association, we don't agree with their submission that it pertains to them also, as I just explained. Yes, that was the only corporate lawyers that made a submission in this respect.
Again, just to reiterate, I want to try and allay the fears of honourable members. This act, Legal Practice Act, is intended, if you make that career choice that Mrs. Lowe is talking about, and you want to practice and you want to have clients from the street, you must be admitted and you must be enrolled. And you've got to do certain, you can only do that once you've had vocational training. So you're going to go through all that training after you've got your academic qualifications, legal qualifications. But if you make a choice after your legal qualifications that you don't want to go and give legal services to the man in the street, then you don't become an officer of the court, you don't get admitted and you don't get enrolled. But then you go and work for a bank or you go and work for the Department of Justice. And that's why the Act doesn't apply to them, because you're not admitted and enrolled. So you are just a person with a qualification. And your rules and regulations are determined, if you're a prosecutor, they're determined by the National Prosecuting Authority. If you work as a law advisor, the Department of Justice, they're determined by the Public Service Commission and by the Public Service Act. So there's always some accountability, but that career choice that you make, if you decide to go into practice and you want to have clients and they pay for your services, then you must have a Fidelity Fund certificate and you must comply with all the requirements pertaining to a Fidelity Fund certificate. If you are like Mrs. Lowe and you're an admitted attorney, but you don't pursue the practice of attorney, then you go on to the non-practicing role. Then you can't go and take clients off the street and render legal services. So there is accountability. You do, and Dr. Chair, you mentioned academics. There are academics, I'm sure most of them are admitted as attorneys or advocates, but they're non-practicing. So there is accountability, and this is what the Act intends to achieve. The Act goes one step further because, and I don't want to complicate things because this is already a complicated issue, as we sit here today, advocates could get admitted, but they haven't necessarily done pupillage, and that's what the Act wants to stop. So that you all, like attorneys, all, if you just go into the advocate profession once this Act becomes law, you can't be let loose on the public just with an LLD degree and you're admitted by the court. You've got to, and when this Act comes into operation, as is the case with attorneys today, people that want to be either attorneys or advocates must be admitted, they must do vocational training, and they must be enrolled. And if they want to be attorneys or practice as advocates with Fidelity Fund certificates, they've got to get those Fidelity Fund certificates, apply for them, and comply with the rules relating to Fidelity Fund certificates, and take out insurance, and they'll be covered by insurance, by virtue, I think, of the Fidelity Fund cover. And that's where the protection of the public comes in. But you can, if you want to remain on the role of advocates or attorneys in terms of the Legal Practice Act, on the non-practicing role, you can do so, but you remain a legal practitioner under the Act. And if you commit, for instance, murder, you can be, your name can be taken off the roll.
That would be a criminal offense.
Yeah.
Now, where do we put the paralegals? Because they are practicing law. Well, how do we deal with the question of paralegals there? Because they are also practicing law. They don't when I applied that it's for certificates.
Chair, the Legal Practice Act only pertains to advocates and attorneys. It does not pertain to paralegals.
The practicing law.
There are certain things that they're not allowed to do in terms of the Attorneys Act. They're not allowed to do certain things. There's a list of stuff that they're not allowed to do, and in fact nobody's allowed to do but attorneys with a Fidelity Fund certificate. But that is something that we are, and I know that the committee is impatient and frustrated that that's not coming, but that's why it's so important to have a paralegals bill where they can be regulated properly and there's certainty about what they can do and can't do and what their qualifications are.
It's a difficult that Parliament has been put into, that you have lawyers basically say paralegals may not do the following, which is something that the legislature must allow or disallow. Now you have interested parties disallowing members of the public to do certain things. And that's why the initial idea was that we must deal with the question of paralegals when we deal with the Legal Practice Bill. But that's water under the bridge. But now we have a situation where we are saying we are legislating for the practicing advocates and attorneys, and then the term legal practitioner does not actually exclude the paralegal. So it means the next day we'll be back here dealing with the same issue. But let me leave this to the honorable members. Honorable Mpumla.
Personally, Honorable Chair, I have a problem. I think people say I'm here, an advocate. I can go now, even without being paid, and go and defend somebody, because the Parliament doesn't want me to take a job. It means, if I'm here and I leave Parliament, I must now register as a practitioner. And I again want to take another job and do register as a practitioner. I fail to understand the difference, and why should we make this particular difference? Particularly with certain people, I mean, who young attorneys, they have no choice. They have done they lost the law degree and they get admitted, but they don't get they are unable to fend on their own. They decided to go and get a job and do something else. Now you keep on jumping. I just don't understand why. And I would think that people can, there's no need to have this distinction. I think if people go and if I practice, of course, then I will. If I join, if I practice and I pay a fidelity fund or something like that, at a particular time, not if I have to be like an attorney. But I don't see why we should put the legislation on that particular difference. I think we say it's enough to say when a person is going to practice and go take money from the public, he needs to pay the heavy fidelity fund certificate. Now that's what I understand. But which means if I'm going to do that as an attorney, I must now say I'm going to pay this from now on because I'm going to do the practice. But what I'm saying is that why should you have that particular distinction? I'm trying to get this. Sometimes we're saying to departments, you employ lawyers just to get other lawyers. Your duty is to get other lawyers. Why can't you guys have some people in-house
attorneys and advocates. Why should you, I employ you as an attorney, ma'am, and then when something is necessary that you need to defend your department, you must get other people to go into the job. Why? So, how do you solve that? Because we don't want you to employ somebody else. We want you to use your brains, your in-house, and do this thing and go to court and do that. You're an admitted attorney. Now, the department doesn't need to get other people to do your job. That's why. No, let's forget about justice pairs here, we're different things, but I'm talking about other departments and so on. And secondly, there are consultants who are in the private sector. They also, when they want, they must also employ somebody who is practicing. Themselves is not practicing, but they defend the department. Where do you put them? So this is the problem of having that distinction, because it's not. I think when you made that, you were thinking in terms of attorneys only, perhaps. You never thought in terms of advocates or even practicing advocates on that point. I don't know. But I'm saying I want to be convinced that there is a need to have that distinction written in the Act.
Let me give you another example. I was admitted as an attorney in 1929. And as an advocate in 1984, there are many land claimants who don't have anybody paying legal fees for them. And in terms of this law, I say there's a grave injustice done to the people. I'm going to defend them free of charge, because I qualify as an attorney, as an advocate, to defend them. So according to this law, I would not be entitled to defend them, although there's no one who can defend them because they cannot afford money. Would that type of legislation be just?
Chair, I suppose you are on the role of advocate. If you say you are admitted as an advocate, then you do fall under the Legal Practice Act.
Non-practicing.
Sorry?
I own the role of non-practicing.
Non-practicing, yes.
But now there's a community that needs a lawyer, but it can't afford a lawyer. And I say, I will do it free of charge for you, because that law will say I may not do it.
Because I'm not.
So will there be access to justice?
Chair, the requirement that a person must have a fidelity fund in specific circumstances is to the protection of the public.
No, but here there's no public. It's people who have no access to justice. Because they don't have money. They don't have money. I say I don't need money. I will go and defend you. Don't pay me. So no one will be prejudiced. The question is now, that type of a loss, does it really advance the interest of justice or the interest of members of a profession?
The scheme of this act is that a person has to make a career choice. You want to become an advocate or an attorney or a corporate lawyer. I am not a practicing attorney because I don't want to do attorney's work. So if my DG comes and tells me I must now appear in court for the department, I wouldn't want to do it. If I wanted to do that, I would go to the state attorney. Same with a corporate lawyer. If a bank needs the type of work that a practicing attorney or advocate does, he has to give instruction to that practitioner. A person works, for example, for a bank because he doesn't want to be a practicing attorney or advocate. It's a choice.
Question is, you want to do both. In other words, what stops you now to go and do this all? You can't do it. You're talking about a question of choice. The question of choice is not permanent, depending on your stomach. If you don't have money, you come from a community where you have to do both. And sometimes you get a job, you go for a job and still want to go and do that particular thing. The question depends if your employer doesn't say no, you can take private jobs. What stops you? Why must you be registered? Can you be registered for both prejudice and non-prejudice? The question is, why must you have that? Is it not restricting? That's the point. That's the question. That's the point you are saying.
I'll come back to you. Let me just follow up. You see, for instance, now, as I speak, there are communities that claimed land in 1998, and they don't have money to pursue the claims because the state is not providing legal funding for them, and the lawyers are not prepared to do work without legal fees. Now the question is, if I say I am not on the role of practicing advocates or attorneys, and I think that an injustice is being done to these communities, I want to go and defend them without charging them because they don't have money. That law would not allow me to do that. And then at the same time, that law would not allow these people to access justice. So will such a law be just? Will it advance access to justice?
Thank you, Chief. I'm a bit lost. I thought the gist of the question was around practicing and unprocessing attorneys.
Correct.
And as to whether they should actually register with the community fund. And we are actually saying this is for protection of the public, because if somebody wants to practice law in South Africa, there should be a way of monitoring as to whether they actually comply with ethical codes and standards. For now, what I hear is questions about whether somebody could actually manage to do certain types of jobs. I think maybe before we go there, like if there's a community that has got a problem with their things that you feel you have legal skills or qualification and you want to go and assist them as to whether it would be right or wrong. But for now, what I want us to conclude is the whole issue of practicing and non-practicing. What are we saying about it? And what came out of the committee earlier is that nobody must practice law in South Africa and monitor. We should then therefore say that the lawyers must register and also then come into play the whole issue of candidates. Where in the midst of all this do we then put candidates? Because they will practice what you would call semi law. And what are we saying about it? Then we haven't started interrogating them. But for us not to cloud issues today, what we want to actually come to the conclusion of is whether practicing or non-practicing laws should be registered with the identity fund. And what's coming out from this side is that they need to be registered for protection of the public.
I think this brings us back to the question that we must work within the mandate that we wanted to facilitate the transition, because when we deal with broader issues, then we end up with the discussion that we have. Kristin?
Just on the specific majority's point, the issue is allow a practicing and non-practicing, both practicing and non-practicing legal practitioners to be subject to the code of conduct. So the subject will be officers of the court. So in that way, a non-practicing attorney would be held accountable if they break that code of conduct or they act contrary to their officer of the court. Then just in terms of the thing around the confusion around advocates, because the Act doesn't really change the situation of attorneys. Attorneys will they have to have a fidelity. A practicing attorney will need to have a fidelity certificate now, but an advocate doesn't need to have a fidelity fund certificate because he or she does not accept work directly from the public.
Isn't the law
put
the
advocates that are practicing and also deal with the public?
Yeah.
So what do you do to cover that?
So in this act, what they've said, like this is how to deal with it, they said that you can have advocates who choose not to take work directly from the public, and they don't need to have a fidelity fund certificate. But as soon as you want to take work directly from the public, and this is an important thing, for a fee or reward or some kind of gain, then you need to have a fidelity fund certificate. And the reason being is that the public has been abused in the past, because once you hand over your money, the money must go into a trust account. But attorneys in the past have stolen money, and the public have not been able to get their money back. So
isn't the intention to create a single, choose the true profession? And then if you refuse the true profession, why should there be this option?
Now I think what we are dealing with, and you correct me if I'm wrong. We want a clarification at the moment for the need to say practicing and non-practicing. I think the issue of fidelity and non-fidelity is something else. Am I mistaken? But I think I don't want to confuse these two. The issue here is that there is a term put in here, practicing and non-practicing. And hence the chair was asking, I am a non-practicing, but I want to go and practice and assist these people. Am I now have to change for that period to becoming a practicing or a non-practicing? The issue is, the question is that why should you have that name put in there? What's so urgent and need and the need to have that practicing distinction made? I understand the difference between fidelity and non-fidelity, cover the fidelity, and that's something different. We can deal with that. But I'm asking now on a straightforward thing and say, why can't I just decide I'm going to defend these people, though I'm working as a clerk somewhere? And why should why should there be? No, I must register now, deregister as a non-practicing, and register as a practicing. And after the case, I go back and become a non-practicing. That's the clear thing that I want clarification.
Thank you, Chair. No, man, I wanted to challenge you.
Sorry, they just want to consult. You can consult because I think this is a matter of education. We don't want to put you in the talk. Yeah. I think the problem where transformation is dictated by dominant forces in society and the public, the silent majority,
has no say, and then we end up in this situation. Partially, we say we require the fidelity certificate to protect the public, but that protection is not holistic, because it leaves other people outside the net. I think that's the concern, but let me not speak for the members. Honorable Kwale, you wanted to.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. No, mine was a clarity, second question. Same with the issue of plantarian advocates vis-a-vis taking work directly from clients. I remember when I was still in practice, there was what we called independent bar, where the advocates were talking directly to clients, and there was a concern that they were charging more than what was expected from them. Now, when the Act says they must get fidelity fund certificates, one is interested to know that would that now applies to the existing independent bar advocates? Will that apply retrospectively?
You know, to follow up there, there are independent bars as we speak now. I've been invited to join an independent bar in Pretoria. Wouldn't someone think that this law is meant to deal with these independent bars, which may be described as rebel bars? Yeah, let's hear the gentleman.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Bafo Momoti. I'm the current chairperson of the National Bar Council of South Africa, formerly called a rebel bar.
Yeah.
Just to put this issue in the right context, my colleague here, Anne Paris, is a practicing advocate here in the Western Cape. Now, when the National Bar Council of South Africa was established in 1994, a few months after the dawn of democracy in South Africa, one of the primary reasons why it was formed was to transform the legal landscape and the profession in South Africa. And most members of the National Bar Council of South Africa and other bars, which I'll mention later, did their pupillage with the General Council of the Bar and its constituent bars. And one of them who did it privilege with the JCBA. But because we had a transformative agenda in mind, we decided to break away from the JCBA, rightfully so, because of the principles enshrined in the Constitution of freedom to associate yourself. Now, there are many bars which are distinct from the General Council of the Bar. The major bar is the National Bar Council of South Africa, formerly known as the Independent Association of Advocates. And that term, independent, meant to distinguish it from the traditional bar. Hence, later on, we changed the name to National Bar Council of South Africa, because there were those members of the profession who roamed the courts and called themselves independent advocates, meaning they do not belong to any structure. They are not governed by any constitution. They are not governed by any ethics. We are not that type of advocate. Now, later on, the National Forum of Advocates, formerly the Criminal Law Bar, was established as a specialist bar by some advocates who broke ranks with the JCB. Another one in Pretoria, called the Chesper Bar, also broke away from the JCB. Another one in Gauteng, for the Gauteng Society of Advocates broke away from GCD, rightfully so, entrenching their constitutional right to associate. And we should bear in mind, the advocate profession in this time, South Africa, is voluntary. It's not governed by any statute, unlike the academic profession. What governs the advocate profession is on admission. If you are admitted, you are fit and proper, and you are appropriately qualified, you may practice law in South Africa in terms of the Admission of Advocates Act. Now what I'm trying to say, the National Bar Council of South Africa is a member to the National Forum, established in terms of the LPA and other bars, etc., etc. We do ventilate issues there with the GCB, Law Society, and other stakeholders. And then I just wanted to clarify the position to say a person may belong to any bar. The reason why we broke away is because we felt that with the dawn of democracy in South Africa, there was no transformation in the legal profession. Hence, we wanted to form our own bar. Thank you, sir.
Can we hear your colleague there from the Western Cape?
Yes.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, just to further that matter, just to go back into the history, talking about fusion, the reason why the National Bar Council, formerly IHASA, was formed was because one of a good example of a fused legal practitioner was the late Dula Umar. He was also an attorney and an advocate, and in 1994, he gave recognition to the independence of advocates. And he recognized that advocates do not have to belong to one authority only, which was the General Council of the Bar. And this is where we have these offshoots of different advocate groupings. Now, when we look at practicing and non-practicing, I would say to make that distinction would be restrictive to legal practitioners. If you want fusion in the profession, if we really want attorneys and advocates to be recognized as legal practitioners, why not, if you want to regulate the protection of certain legal work, such as transfer of property in for conveyancing, then stipulate legislation as to how that particular legal practitioner should work in that particular field. Not just have a general legislation and make distinction between a paralegal, an attorney, or an advocate. We should actually be looking to moving towards one type of legal practitioner.
Yeah, I want to say that that's very useful. I think we shouldn't operate like we are putting the officials in the dock. Free to participate because we really want to come up with a piece of legislation that is beneficial to the people of South Africa, not just to practitioners. So, but can we bear in mind the mandate and go back to the mandate? Can you summarize where we are in terms of the mandate?
Chair, yes. This is quite difficult. The two gentlemen that have just spoken from about the private bars, that is in fact the position. But the Act doesn't prohibit the formation of these different bar councils or whatever you want to call them. That can go ahead. But what the Act does, and I'm not trying to stop the debate or hinder it or abandon
it.
What I'm finding difficult, Chair, is we're sitting with an Act that's an Act of Parliament, and we're trying to work and respond to what is on the statute book. And yes, we're hearing things that the Act shouldn't be the way it is, that should be a fused profession. And that's what the original legal practice act tried to do many, many, many years ago, and then the result was a compromise, and that's what we're sitting with, is a fait accompli, still with a divided profession, and not a viewed profession. That was a compromise that was made in 2014. But that is something. If we need to change that, then I don't think we can do it in a bill, an amendment bill, because it's a fundamental departure from the cornerstone of what is in this very thick piece of legislation. And as has been explained, what this act also is trying to do for the protection of the public is advocates, as the gentleman here said, all stands now. The only act that regulates advocates is the Admission of Advocates Act. You can get admitted as an advocate with the strength of an LLB. And you can get your LLB one day and get all your papers in order and go and get admitted as an advocate, and then you can get let loose on the public. And there have been abuses, and there have been bad abuses, and this is what this act is trying to stop, among others. So that advocates will be treated like attorneys. You'll get your legal qualifications, you'll go through vocational training, and you'll be admitted and enrolled the same way as attorneys, so that you don't have a situation where advocates are just thrown out to the public and work out of boots of cars. And that is what we're trying to do. But as I say, I'm finding it difficult to respond because I'm hearing the sentiments that are coming out. And we're sitting with a piece of legislation that's different.
I think that strengthens the position that let's focus on the extension of the life of the forum. Because we can see that there are struggles that still have to take place within that forum. And then those struggles then will lead to a situation where we will have to be dealing with the amendment of the legislation to deal with the person, for instance, whether or not we are fusing, because we can have the compromises 20, 30 years into the new democracy. Compromises are matters of transition. We can't be in transition for 50 years. Can we focus on the matters pertaining to the mandate given, and so that, because if we don't meet the deadline of the extension, then we have another problem in our hands.
And please, no free agent. We want to guarantee the facility. As you've indicated, that case on the National Bank Handbook, it may be important for us to make it. This whole thing about independence, Freedom of Association should actually be acknowledged, but within the law.
That we need to actually
manage to capture. Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure, are we done with the discussion of Clause 3? Is it acceptable?
Okay,
the act in many respects refer to practicing and non-practicing. It makes that distinction. It does not make the distinction in Section 33 of the Act, and Clause 3 just want to rectify that and for the protection of the public, but the Act already makes a distinction between practicing and non-practicing, just not in Section 33, where we feel it should go into. That is what Clause 3 is all about.
So I just want to find out that, aren't we changing that or removing that practice,
which is there?
Are we not amending the act as far as that is concerned? Because if
there's no clarity on let's say one is man and he is not restricted.
That's the point. If it is, why should we have a distinction which is discriminating against other people or restricting people from being gay, from pretending for their constitutional rights, and as the chairperson as a leader? What I'm trying to say is, I would suggest that we just move it, if possible. They need distinction, unless I am convinced that there is a need for such a thing. Because it's separate from the question of what you correctly call the money that is collected for judicial certificates and so on, by elite certificates. But what I'm trying to say is that in this field, connected with the diffusion, in a way, so-called fusion of this profession, do we need to make it absolutely necessary?
You know, our Honorable Newman also raised a critical matter to say I'm not only practicing, or I work for a bank, and then there's a matter before the court, and I would be more qualified because I'm an insider in the bank to go and appear. And we make a law which says, no, you must be having a fidelity certificate. But in the bank, you don't need, you are a corporate lawyer, you don't need a fidelity certificate. And you are a lawyer, you are qualified. Why should you, the bank, go and employ another lawyer when they have a lawyer that they pay and who would be more qualified to defend them?
Chair, if the committee and parliament wishes to change the law in that way, it goes beyond the scope of this amendment bill. It would entail a new direction of a total change of the current Legal Practice Act. So that is the only way I can respond to that, other than that what Clause 3 tries to do is just to bring into line with the rest of the current scheme of the Act, namely the distinction between practicing and non-practicing. That distinction is currently ingrained in the current Act. So if it were to be removed, it would go beyond the scope of this amendment. Well, it might be a better place next in future. We foresee that there will be necessary changes to this Act for implementation purposes. And even if a fusion route is followed, it is such a big departure from the current Act that we can't do that in this amendment bill. This amendment bill is only to get the ball rolling with the current Act that we have on the table.
Honourable Member, tell me that answer.
It does give an answer, but it also brings back to what I was talking about before. The problem with South Africa now is that there is a constitutional democracy more than parliamentary. Anybody will run to court and say that act is unconstitutional, and because it's discriminating or they've got this and that and that. We go on with this bill, restricted, fine, and let it pass just to patch up what main thing, what we notice to be, could be challenged. And we catch it up. And then we do that, and then we wait somebody to go to court. And then the court says, change that. Then you rush and try and do that. What I'm trying to say is that having noticed some of the problems within the act itself, I would think that personally, mandate could be extended. And how it takes that and what it means to me is a shorter route than to finish this thing and start again. If this particular thing we're talking about is going to be challenged, like restricting people and so on, And as the chairperson correctly put it, he wants to assist, and this is, I think he's very passionate about it. He is actually would ask anybody, including us, to go and assist people who in the land claims and things like that. But if there is a restriction in this particular act to that effect, that may even be challenged constitutionally. Thank you very much.
Why don't we agree that that is legitimate, but it would be something that will be dealt with in the amendment, because quite clearly there's going to be a need to amend that. But now we just want to extend the life of the forum. And I guess these points are being noted, and the department will have to go back and say, from this discussion, it's clear that there are more questions than answers. And then they will have to come back to us with an amendment, and then the struggle can continue.
For now,
if we extend the mandate in respect of one issue, the other issue will arise, and then we may end up extending the mandate in respect of all the issues, and maybe end up going beyond our mandate ourselves.
Chair, I just want to reiterate, we're not trying to push a particular viewpoint, and the sentiments I understand coming out here very strongly, that we could go with the approach that you might want to include it in the committee report. To try and change that now, it seems like a small technical change, but it won't be. It goes to the heart of this 2014 Act, and there have to be so many consequential amendments. And when I say that, I really not trying to create the impression that it would be unwilling, or we're working within the framework of what is before us.
I think the honourable members will understand. We don't want a consequential challenges, because otherwise we will ourselves be creating a problem. I think the members have made it clear that there are more questions than answers, but for the purpose of the mandate that is before us, we cannot deal with all those issues. Can we proceed now within the mandate?
Thank you, Chair. Can I move on to the comment on clause 4?
Chair, the one from banking council also relates to what we already discussed about the corporate council.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 4 amends section 91 of the Act. It is just a very small technical change. The wording a bank statement is changed to say transaction history, and it also says that the council or the board, which refers to the Fidelity Fund board, may request this from a bank. This is to the oversight of the how attorneys and in future certain advocates manage their trust accounts. So it's very technical, because it was found that the word statement is limiting in what information the bank provides. In certain instances, the council or the board will need more information than what is given on a statement. So the National Council of the Board supports this clause. Then there was a person who made comment on this, that she says that it is, she can't see why the words should change. She doesn't give her reasons, but in the department's view, it is better to say transaction history, because it is easier then to see whether an account was mismanaged than a mere balance. The Gender Commission also supports this clause. So in this clause there was not really any substantial comment.
Honourable, I think there's nothing that can persuade us to defer the department. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Section 96 of the Act refers to the duration of the National Forum, and there was the National Forum requested that their duration be extended until the Council meets with the Minister as provided for in the Act, and that the term is not only 3 years as stated in the Act at the moment. And the Department supports this because the Minister has given so far a 9-month extension to the National Forum for its activities, so this would fall into line with that extension.
They want to continue until they meet with the Minister, and that should not be limited to 3 years. And we make such a law. That's what I would prefer to do. Honourable members.
Chair, if I could just add there, sorry, I summarised it a bit. Currently, Section 96(4) of the Act provides that the duration of the National Forum is for a period not exceeding 3 years and ceases to exist on the date of commencement of Chapter 2. Now, the proposed amendment refers to Section 105 of the Act, and Section 105(3) provides that the National Forum must, before its dissolution, meet with the Council contemplated in Section 4 for purposes of handing over. I'm sorry, I think I spoke wrongly. The first amendment is that it should read, the National Forum ceases to exist on the date of the meeting with the Council as envisaged in Section 105 or such other date as the Minister may determine. So the meeting is with the Council, but the Minister has a role in that he can determine a date.
But already the 3 years has expired.
No, Chair, the 3 years expires on 1 February next year.
And they want an extension until when? For long?
The Minister already gave them an extension of their 2-year mandate. They were supposed to do certain things within 24 months. The Minister has extended that period until the end of October, so it was with 9 months that it was extended. So already the statutory deadlines is becoming a bit problematic.
But now you see, it would seem we're going back to the terms of the TPA now, where we will govern by proclamations. Because Parliament doesn't make proclamations. Parliament makes laws. We want to make a law as part of transformation. Honourable members, there is a proposal, but I just feel that we're going back to the Transvaal provincial, Cape Town provincial administrations now.
Yes, I think I really feel for. In fact, even if we extend it, which I think maybe persuaded to do, there is a problem. I think they have got a very big horse there called the Bar Council that is resisting even to cooperate. However, I think that the minister, I think let's leave it to the minister, there are no provisions here that the minister may extend it. Because since it's a transitional thing, if we have to alter, we'll alter giving a discretion on the minister to extend it where necessary. Rather than we decide to put another extension, say it should be 5 years instead of 6, you know. Is there no provision in it that says the minister has got discretion? If he extended it, what discretion do you have? I mean, do you use anything? Is there any provision for that?
Legal forum was given 3 years to transform. They haven't managed in the 3 years. Why shouldn't we then extend and put a definite date by which they must do that? Because failure to transform has an impact on the delivery of justice and access to justice itself.
Honorable Mr. Bassett?
Chair, I was going to suggest that maybe that's the way to go.
Christine?
Perhaps it would be helpful if we had some kind of idea of exactly what still needs to be done and the associated time frame for the National Forum to complete its work. So Ms. Moore was actually talking about that there are regulations that need to be published, and that would obviously involve some kind of process around that. There are things that, specific things that need to be put in place before the council can complete. So we had a better idea of exactly what those were and what the time frame, reasonable time frames associated with that, we could then make an informed decision about some kind of completion date.
But you say lawyers are reasonable people. And when we said for 3 years, we were informed by them. Now, if we are going to give them an indefinite period informed by things that we don't know, it means we are keeping this transformation, placing it at the mercy of lawyers. And Parliament does not exist for lawyers, it exists for society. Honourable members, are we giving a definite extension or just keep it open?
The problem
I'm having is that I'm not sure what, if when they were here, I didn't hear them saying we have got these problems that we teach within such a time we'll be able to come. And I don't know whether Mr. President, you know why, and if we give them so much, that is likely to happen. Or we just take it up from our tips and say, this is the definite, they indicated that definitely, or more or less, by within 2 years or 3 years, this will be done. I don't want them to come back to us and say, look, after all, let's extend again, and so on.
The department doesn't seem to have a problem in giving a definite period. And the question is, what would be that reasonable period? But this thing of saying, subject to the minister, we have a separation of power. We are parliament. We must make a law that is definite, that is certain, because the public there out there need to know where we are going.
We are in your hands, so if you want, if that's the way you want it, if you wanted a definite date, what we could do is quickly try and engage with the National Forum, and I would like to think that they don't need that much longer. And then
in your view, how much do you think is a reasonable advocate?
I'd say that they've already got an extension. Things have been put on hold because they've asked for an extension, and Ms. Lowe said by 9 months already, so maybe we're looking between 9 months and a year. I don't know. I would like to get a sense from the committee what they think is reasonable, because what is reasonable for the National Forum might not be reasonable for the committee.
Perhaps they could flag, we can decide in principle that we want to have a definite date, and we can flag the period while we do a little bit of investigation about what actually needs to be done, and then we can decide whether it's okay or not.
You know, when you deal with lawyers, there are so many opinions. We are parliament. We don't only represent lawyers. We want certainty.
Mr. Bassett.
You say 9 months to a year, and on the first, the legal forum will be here, and because we are a democratic institution, we can give them a hearing on the first and hear them before we fix the time. Can we leave it that way?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we will finalize the matter of the period.
Chairperson, I think also we need to limit capacities in the forum. I don't know how, but it's about engaging the minister. How are we going to do it?
You see, we created the forum as parliament to do certain things. And when the forum is not able to meet the deadline, they come back to us for an extension. But we can't say at this forum, take the ministry's representatives, they're speaking for themselves, and we have the benefit of what the ministry thinks, but we don't have the benefit of what the forum is saying. So we're saying the forum will be here on the first. Why don't we allow the forum, and the minister will be here, and then we can then find a solution from there. For now, we leave the question of the duration until the 1st of November.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 6 amend section 97 of the Act. Now, 97 relates to the terms of reference of the National Forum. Clause 6A deletes subsection 1A subparagraph 4, and this relates to the manner in which provincial councils must be elected, as this is already in the provision that provides for the rules. I will get back to that in a moment. Then clause 6B is just a grammatical error that's being rectified. Clause 6C refers to the section 109 that provides for the rules that must be made, and there is a subsection inserted, subsection 3, that is dealt with in clause 7. And that subsection provides that the National Forum must make the rules that must be made in future by the Council. And I will explain that in a moment. And then clause 6B amends subsection 2A by replacing that subsection so that it will read, the National Forum must, within 24 months of the commencement of this chapter, negotiate with and reach an agreement with the law societies in respect of the transfer of their assets, etc., to the council or provincial council, as well as the date on which the law society shall be dissolved and such transfer effective, provided that such date may not be later than 6 months after the commencement of Chapter 2. And then Clause 6E adds a subsection 6 to Section 97 to provide that the National Forum must at least 6 months before the date of commencement of Chapter 2 make recommendations to the Minister for purposes of making the regulations contemplated in Section 94. Chief, this looks quite complicated. It is not really as complicated. The Act provides that the Council must make certain rules in future and that the Minister must make in future rules regarding several matters. But the National Forum has its limited mandate, which must also go into regulations made by the Minister, and they must also make certain rules. They requested, for the purpose of continuation and smooth transition, that the first set of regulations and rules must be made by them, that it's not waited until the permanent council is established, and on that day there's no rules, there's no regulations. So they actually offered to assist with the getting this thing off the ground. And then obviously the new council can amend anything, and the minister in future can amend everything. So all these subsections and subclauses only goes to that, to provide that they can do the first set just to get the ball rolling. The fear is that there will come a day when the council comes into place and the law societies dissolve and there's nothing. No rules, no regulations, no structure. So this is what this is all about.
Unless I'm mistaken, what we are used to is that the minister makes regulations, and regulations must be approved by parliament. Now you have a situation where there will be rules which are internal to the forum, which rules are supposed to influence the regulations of the minister, and the time frame is two years in addition to the extension that is being sought now, and you say that is not complicated.
Yes, the act as it stands now, maybe I should go one step backwards. In terms of the current Attorneys Act, there are rules that deal with internal issues, and there are plenty of those rules. And the Attorneys Act gives the Statutory Law Society the power to make rules, and there are also regulations. So the council, the regulatory body, makes rules. That's the way it works now, and that in terms of the Attorneys Act, and that's what is also proposed in the Legal Practice Act. And the minister makes regulations on certain things. The minister makes regulations on policy issues, quite correctly. And those regulations must, not all regulations are approved by Parliament, but when this act was deliberated on, it was suggested that any regulations that are made by the minister must be approved by Parliament, because they go to the heart of issues and deal with so many things relating to access to justice, professional vocational training, and that sort of thing. So, and maybe incorrectly, it was thought that the National Forum should do some preparatory work and make recommendations to the minister on what pertaining to regulations that should be made. And the minister doesn't have to make those regulations. The minister considers the recommendations coming from the National Forum. The Act in the transitional provisions also gives the National Forum the power to make certain rules to regulate internal issues within the profession. But the National Forum came to us, and that's why we have the bill, and said they fear the day when this Act comes into operation, because they, the National Forum, have very limited powers in the book in what rules can be made and what regulations can be made by the Minister. And for the sake of continuity and for the sake of ensuring that nothing comes to a complete standstill on the date that the Legal Council comes into operation, that we broaden the mandate of the National Forum to put in place everything that needs to be in place, so that when the National Council comes into operation, there are rules for everything, and not just what the limited issues that were originally in the Act. So we want to increase the mandate of the National Forum to come up with rules more than what the Act allows them to do at the moment. And that's in the interests of the profession. It's not in the interests of the profession, it's more in the interests of the public, to make sure that everything is in place and there's not, on a particular day, everything comes to a dead halt because the council, the newly appointed council, must now follow a process to get those rules in place and to make recommendations to the minister on the regulations that must be made. So, in effect, is what what the provisions are about is to not only what the bill is about is not only to extend the time or the duration of the council, and we said that in the briefing, but also to extend the mandate of the national forum to make rules and to make recommendations on regulations, and that's what clause 6 I think is about.
I have a proposal that because we have a request of the forum to be here, that we don't sit here and be second guessing the forum. We get a date when the forum will be here, when they will be able to answer for themselves, and then we have this matter. And we deal with the international arbitration deal when we have to finalize that bill, and then we postpone this matter, because otherwise we have been second guessing. Honourable members, I'm just putting that proposal that we really postpone this discussion until the forum is here, and then we deal with this. And then we move to the international arbitration deal, which is can we move on to that?
Yes, I would agree for the postponement of the matter, of the matter. But I would also want the arbitration. For example, I didn't bring all the on the things of the arbitration. Can we, when are we meeting with the arbitration? Now or after lunch?
Good afternoon, sitting.
Well,
there are
quite a number of things that are in the arbitration. I think there are a lot of people came up with so many things in it. I don't know. Do you think we do justice to all that?
Yes, actually, when we actually met, there was a sense of what remained were just technical amendments. Let's hear those technical amendments.
Secondly, I want to say that I have reservations on the this thing of self-regulation on various professions. This is an old thing, but I don't think sometimes it may be correct.
Just to get the meeting order, do we agree that we postpone this issue on the legal practice bill? We'll deal with it when the forum is here, and then now we'll deal with the arbitration bill, because we have a sitting in the afternoon, and there are technical things we have to finalize that arbitration. So we agree, but you can come back on that issue when we have the forum here. Mr. Bassett, can you address us? We have A and B.
Chairperson, may I be excused?
I hope you will be back here because you are in for some very happy.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Now in the A version of the book. Clause 5, we've been searching the words international commercial so that it refers to international commercial arbitration. And we're doing so at the suggestion of one of the commentators because I think it makes it clearer that what we refer to is international commercial arbitration because that is what the bill is about. In Clause 9, thank you, Chair. In Clause 9, Clause 9 deals with immunity of arbitrators and arbitral institutions, and it was suggested by one of the commentators that we also extend that immunity not only to the employees of an arbitrator, but also persons appointed by the arbitral tribunal. So it really is just a sensible insertion, and that's also been converted into the A list, which is currently before honourable members. The amendment, as you can see, clause 17, I don't think I even really need to discuss it. There was an and between subparagraphs 1 and 2, where it should be an or, and that's what we have done. You'll see it in the A list. Schedule 4 entails an amendment to the schedule to the bill, and we're proposing an amendment, consequential amendment, to the Carriage of Goods by Sea Act, and this addresses an oversight on our part as raised by the Maritime Law Association. And as I said last week, this consequential amendment was agreed to between the Maritime Law Association and APSA, Operation Federation Foundation of Southern Africa. And we indebted, I want to remind honourable members, to Advocate Lindy Kuposi Thomas, who helped us with that together with Professor Butler. That concludes the provisions of the bill, Honourable Chair. There were some technical amendments proposed to Schedule 1 to the bill, and that's the model law itself. And Article 12.1 deals with grounds for challenge. And all we've done is bring about technical amendments to make it read better. It used to read person who is approached, and we propose that it now reads when a person is approached with his or her possible appointment of the arbitrator. So we're not changing the substance, we're just making it more readable and bringing it into line with the original. Article 31.7, it was proposed that we add the word arbitral to before the word tribunal, so it reads the arbitral tribunal and makes it clearer. Those are the proposed technical amendments to the model law. Then we can move on to the amendments to Schedule 2 to the bill, and that's arbitral conciliation rules. Article 1.1, we suggest an amendment where there's an insertion of the word the. It's a technical correction. It should have been there in the first place. And
the presentation will be done in 3 minutes, and then we're going to vote in each 6 minutes.
People have got an international call exactly at 1 o'clock. Can you allow me to do that? If now 1 o'clock, you talk about it, be there. What do I do?
Let's vote now before you go.
No, I agree. I agree.
No, let's respect the rules of the committee. Sit down, the presentation is done. Let's do everything formally. Let's do everything formally. That's for me. Just sit down. We had an expert presentation by Professor Butler, and then we were informed that there are technicalities left. Those technical changes have been effected. Now it's a question of do we now accept the bill with those amendments as effected. Any proposal for acceptance?
Can we take a hand for our acceptance of the view? Honorable Mutapu. Draw the mic towards you.
Move for what? Acceptance of adoption.
The proposal for adoption of the bill. Second, Honorable Majafi. Speak to the mic.
Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. I second proposal to adopt the bill.
Any opposition?
I don't oppose it, but it will save to our progress.
Thank you. That's a legal practice, that's right. The report on. No, I just want me to. The report on the bill. A proposal for the acceptance of the report on the bill, which has been before us. Okay, we'll propose formally. Then I will deal with that.
Okay, I move for adoption of the report.
Any seconder?
I second the report.
Any opposition? No opposition, so the report is adopted, and thank you very much. I must thank you very much. This was the most lively debate, and that's how Parliament should be. Parliament should not rubber stamp things. Parliament should debate them. And we must thank the department for the thorough preparation. We've been able just to have this rigorous debate. I hope that in future we'll also have this rigorous debate. Thank you very much. And we're looking forward to the appearance of the forum for further engagement. Thank you very much. And you are all excused.